It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosie.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosie.
Hello there, film lovers, and welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD To The Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. Also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Sosie. The show is available as a podcast. It's also available on iTunes. And we have a blog, which you can check out at
filmsociology.tumblr.com.
The voice you heard is Kobe Slagle.
Yep.
He also thinks Bo Ryan is still bitter. And it's pledge time. So if
That's
you
right.
enjoy...
Membership campaign time.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. It's Public Radio American. If you enjoy the programming on HD1 and HD2... Call 1-800-233-0020 or go to WFYI.org to support Film Sociology and The Cool Down and The Blues House Party and all the other programs that don't feature Kobe and I. 1-800-233-0020 or WFYI.org. Now, from time to time, of course, when we have membership drives like these, we usually put in special shows or sometimes classic shows. We have a really special show today because as I was going through the week, did I want to talk about Helen Mirren sharing screen time with Ryan Reynolds? That's probably a no, Kobe. Do I want to talk about the new Nicholas Sparks movie?
No.
I want another excuse to talk about the fact that Blackula is now available on Blu-ray and I have a link and a connection. Joining me on Film Sociology is the gentleman who did the commentary for the Blu-ray of Blackula. He is an artist, a filmmaker. He's got his own website called badasmofro.com. I can say that because it's Z's. David Walker's on the line here. How are you, David?
Doing good. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. And for the record, I'm wearing my Blackula shirt on the show.
Yep.
There you go.
So I guess to start with, how did you get the gig to do the commentary?
You know, it's an interesting question, and I'm still not 100% sure how I got that gig. I did a documentary years and years ago about blaxploitation films, and one of the people that I interviewed in that documentary was William Marshall, who starred as Blackula. And so somehow along the way, I'm assuming that someone at Shout Factory who released the Blackula Blu-ray must have seen my documentary and just decided to reach out to me. That's a logical explanation that makes some semblance of sense. So that's the story I'm going with.
And he's sticking to it. Just out of curiosity, I mean, did you do it in real time or as close as you could?
I did it all in one take. They had reached out to me like months and months in advance and asked if I was interested. And I said, yeah. And, I went into a studio and they popped in the movie and I just, bam, just did it all in one take, which the engineer said was pretty unusual, but, you know, I'm not your typical guy, so.
Which is why we love having you on this show. tell me about can you remember the first time you actually saw Blackula?
The first time I saw it was, and I'm pretty sure I talked about this on the commentary, was it would have been it was on television. You know, I'm assuming it must have been the first time it aired on TV, which would have been sometime in the late 70s. And I just remember at the time, you know, being really young and remembering that there's a scene that really scared me. It's still a scene that scares me. The rest of the movie I don't find too terrifying, but... I had the whole scene emblazed in my memory, which is the scene where this woman comes back as a vampire and attacks Elisha Cook in the morgue. And so for years, I didn't want to watch the movie again because it scared me so bad as a kid, that one particular scene. And then, you know, years later, I watched it again and was like kind of embarrassed that the entire movie as a whole scared me, even though this one particular scene was still pretty effective.
I think everybody has one of those. I remember the first time I saw Vincent Price's Madhouse.
Mm-hmm.
I had to have been in my single digits, and that scared the bejesus out of me. And then I saw it, you know, about a decade or so later, and like you, I was like, oh, yeah, okay. Kobe, do you have any of those?
Yes, I do.
And by the way, for the record, David, Kobe is not pro horror movie.
No,
not his bag.
All.
So
not at all. So this kind of, Dave, this kind of goes in the same line. Like, very scary the first time you see it, and then later, you know, you're embarrassed by the whole, you know, rest of the movie. Saw Signs in theaters. I was, I don't know, 12, 13, whatever.
Well, I think the idea of Mel Gibson being a farmer scares the crap out of anybody. But.
The scene, news. I think it's a news crew that arrives to the kid's house or whatever, and the kids are like, it's behind, and the crew's running through the house, and then they go to, like, the, you know, the kitchen window that's over the sink, and you see, you know, out to the backyard and the fields, and then you see just, like, a foot, like, walking into the cornfields and stuff. It's like, nope.
So you're, mm-hmm. You haven't watched it since?
Yeah, I've seen it one time since, and yeah, it's kind of, wow, this was it, but.
That's okay. That was like when I showed my daughter Jaws, which I told her scared the crap out of me when I was 5, and her response was, she saw it last year, she was 12. I can see why that would have scared you when you were 5. Thank you, little hipster child. You know, but I do know the scene you're thinking of. It's, you were talking about, Dave, it's the cab driver who hops up out of the sheet. If you think about the film, I know from a technical standpoint, it's not a Hitchcock film by any stretch of the imagination. But the use of slow motion and the weird makeup, it's very effective still.
Yeah, and the sound design in that particular scene, the music, and she's making this weird sound, and it's just one, you know, and going back to movies that you saw when you were younger, there's a long list of movies that, you know, freaked me out in one capacity or another, and then I go back and watch them as an adult, and it's like, well, I was just an idiot, you know, like what was wrong with me as a kid? And a lot of times, there's a movie called Grizzly,
yep,
that William Girdler did in, like, 76 or 77. It was a ripoff of Jaws.
Yep.
And I went back and watched that like maybe 4 or 5 years ago, and I can't even find the scene. Like, I remember being scared by the movie. I remember the scenes that scared me the most, but when I watched them, I'm like, there's nothing scary about these scenes. So at least with Blackula, there's one scene that remains intact that still has its horrific element that has not aged out, at least for me. So.
Mm-hmm. I think the other thing that is timeless, and you've talked about this on the commentary, and I think it's kind of universal, is William Marshall's performance. Who,
yeah.
I think, I don't know if you follow baseball. I think of William Marshall in Blackula, and I think of Steve Carlton when he won the Cy Young Award for the 72 Phillies. Like, he won 27 games, and the Phillies won like 60 as a team that year. Or Michael Jordan the first time with the Bulls, where he would score 50 or 60, and the rest of the team would score, you know, a combined 20.
Yeah.
He's just great in it. And one of the things I loved about it, and it kind of reminded me of Charlton Heston doing his sci-fi films in the 70s, was he treated the material with respect. And with Marshall, I mean, it was like a Shakespearean tragedy.
Yeah, no, it really was. It's like, I was just talking to someone about a week ago about Blackula, and that was the exact same conversation we were having. We were like, you know, there's no reason that the movie should be this good. There's no reason that it should stand any sort of test of time. And then you realize, oh, well, the movie isn't that good. The movie doesn't really stand the test of time. It's William Marshall and his performance that's good. He's what elevates the movie and gives it this sort of timeless. If there's anything classic about the movie, it's him and his performance and what he brings to the overall production.
Yeah, I mean, he just wipes the floor with anybody who gets in his way. And I know in your documentary, you show the scene in Scream, Blackula, Scream, where he's confronted by two pimps, one of which was Bob, stuntman Bob Minor. Another. I mean, just literally and symbolically, just destroyed anybody who crossed his path, acting wise and character wise.
Yeah, and that's probably one of the two best scenes in that movie. They didn't, you know, for whatever reason, they didn't ask me to do an audio commentary for a second. I probably wouldn't have been able to be as kind to it as I was to the first one, and I would certainly have some critical moments of that first film for sure.
I was slightly disappointed. I'm not going to say gypped. I was slightly disappointed. But then again, if I did a commentary of that, it would be 90 minutes of just looking at Pam Grier. So
that, yeah, right.
that's probably not what they want. Have you seen William Marshall's Othello?
I've never seen the whole thing, and I know that if you're willing to pay money for it, I know that it's out there. I think it's even on DVD.
I have a copy of it.
VHS.
Yeah, I have a copy of it. Ron Moody's is Iago. So you have Blackula and Fagin in the same production, and it's very cool.
I've seen clips of him as Othello. I don't know if it's from that same production. He was on tour like in 72, 73. I believe that's when that was made, but I could be wrong. And it's something that's on my wish list of things I need to check out at some point.
And I know, do we know if there's any video of his Thurgood Marshall one-man show?
To the best of my knowledge, there isn't. And the other thing that's really interesting, and I was just having another conversation, I just got back from a convention down in L.A., so people are still talking about this Blackula Blu-ray. William Marshall was in a TV show in the late 50s called Harlem Detective, and I think it was on CBS. And there's nothing of that anywhere. Like, can't even find clips of that on YouTube or anything. And I've checked at the UCLA Film Archive and a couple other places. And it ran, like, I want to say 12 or 13 episodes. And it was, you know, it was an early network television program where he played a detective in the Harlem precinct in New York City.
And he was the lead?
There's a couple of really good things out there, potentially really good performances by him out there that are just missing.
Okay.
Which is a crime.
Absolutely. I'd love to see that. It's because, you know, I think prior to that, after that, we know him from Star Trek, and we know him from Boston Strangler and Demetrius and the Gladiators, just kind of, you know, parts here and there. But, yeah, I would love to see a series wrapped around him. That would have been great.
Yeah, no, it's kind of interesting. There's, you know, I always tell people that there's more stuff out there, you know, between the internet and even home video. People think that, you know, that everything that was ever made is out there, and it's still a small percentage of stuff. There's still so many things that were produced. A lot of it isn't particularly good, but every now and then you stumble across something that's actually really solid, and you're like, how come this hasn't, you know, been preserved, or it's not better known? And, you know, a lot of there's some good stuff on YouTube, but not everything is out there.
And the studios, I know, were known to recycling and just trashing film once they were done with it.
Yeah.
So, how did Marshall get involved with Blackula?
My understanding from everything I've read, and even my interview with him when he talked about it, was just they had approached him about playing the part, and he agreed with, you know. The major caveat was that he wanted to change the backstory of the character. Originally, the character was just was a slave who had been, you know, bitten by Dracula and then becomes Blackula. And he wanted to give the character a much richer, fuller backstory with the whole African royalty ancestry story angle. So. Samuel Arkoff, who was the head of AIP, agreed to that, and that's really what gives the story. I think it's, you know, that's the what really drives it for me.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, the opening scene, you got a little bit of social commentary, which, you know, for a drive-in or a downtown movie theater on a Saturday night, that's not bad.
Yeah.
And I think you said on the commentary that originally his character's name was Amos Brown.
Yes.
There's a radio personality in Indy with the same name. He's not thrilled with this joke. So,
well, Amos Brown is also the name of on the Amos and Andy show.
Forgot about the last name. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ooh, good move, William. Yeah, because I'm trying to remember. I know at that time, you know, when films were being made for the black audiences, they were kind of remakes. I know, like, Cool Breeze was a remake of The Asphalt Jungle.
Yep.
And Hitman was kind of an urban version of Get Carter. And I'm trying to think, this came before those, is that right?
Yeah. Blackula came pretty early in you know, the what they call blaxploitation, what's referred to as blaxploitation. Blackula came along pretty early in that whole movement, if you want to call it that. And it was also, what people don't realize is that it showed on TV. It was only rated PG, and so it actually went into television rotation, mostly in syndication, which is another reason why it has a longer shelf life than a lot of the other movies. It came out in 72, and, you know, like, most people don't really consider blaxploitation kicking off until 71. I would argue that it started before that, but so 72 was like, 71, 72 were the years that was all ramping up, and then 73, 74 were like the big years. That's where just a ton of the movies came out. Blackula just happened to come along like fairly early on, and it was a hit. And and then you throw in the fact that it got television play pretty early on. It went into syndication pretty early on. All those things were factors, whereas like a movie like Hitman, I mean, I think Hitman probably didn't show up on television until, you know, the era of cable, when it showed, the first time I ever saw it was like on TBS or something like that, or TNT. A lot of those movies, because they were rated R, they didn't necessarily find a home on network television or Saturday afternoon television.
Mm-hmm. When do you think the wave of films began?
You know, it for me, it really started like in 1970. I'd say 70, just because it's an easy date to throw out there. And, you know, 1970 was the year that Cotton Comes to Harlem comes out, and Cotton Comes to Harlem was pretty significant in terms of its financial success at the box office and paving the way for a lot of other things. So, but there's other movies that came along in the late 60s. Uptight came along in 68, and so did The Split with Jim Brown.
Right.
And then in 1970, you also had Watermelon Man with Godfrey Cambridge. That was directed by Melvin Van Peebles.
And a studio picture.
Yeah, studio picture. Hal Ashby's directorial debut, The Landlord, was also 1970. So, and also like The Liberation of L.B. Jones. So there was a lot of movies that sort of paved the way. The two movies that most people think of are Shaft and Superfly, and those came along in 71. But, you know, Shaft and
Sweet Sweetback.
Sweetback's badass.
Yeah.
But where would Sweet Sweetback be if, you know, Van Peebles hadn't done Watermelon Man in 70 and Story of a Three-Day Pass before that? And MGM certainly probably wouldn't have been so eager to Shaft if they hadn't had the big hit of Cotton Comes to Harlem on their hands.
And didn't Across 110th Street also come out in 70?
No, I think that was, I'd have to double check, but I think it's 71 or 72.
Okay.
72 is when it came out.
Okay.
So that was like the same year as Blackula. That was like, 72 or 73 is where you got movies like Trouble Man and The Spooky Sabador and Across 110th Street. And some of the, it was before the studios really just started going bonkers and just releasing anything they could get hands on.
And I'm still waiting for a Blu-ray release of Come Back Charleston Blue.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, they put out, I believe Cotton Comes to Harlem out on Blu-ray, and I know Across 110th Street is. I don't know why Warner Brothers is sitting on like three or four titles that not only are not on Blu-ray, they didn't put them out on DVD. They didn't put out Come Back Charleston Blue. They didn't put out Brothers. I'm trying to remember what the third one was that I'm really kind of surprised and disappointed.
My first question would be maybe the soundtrack rights.
Yeah, you know, it could be, but I mean, all the stuff came out on VHS, and so if you would make, you'd have to make the assumption that if the video rights were there for VHS, they'd be there for Blu-ray and DVD. But Warner Brothers was slow to release Come Back Charleston Blue. They didn't release that until the mid to late 90s on VHS. It was, they released three, as a matter of fact, so I'm thinking about it. They'd released Come Back Charleston Blue, Black Samson, and then Brothers. All three of those they released on VHS at the same time. And they've since released Black Samson on DVD. So I think someone has just determined that there's not enough money to be made from putting it out, and that's why they haven't done it. That's my guess anyway.
That's fine. That's all right. Now, I know with the success of Blackula, that kind of opened the floodgates for horror films to be made for the downtown audience. I'm trying to remember in the commentary, you still think Sugar Hill is the finest of the lot?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, there's Ganja and Hess, which was written and directed by Bill Gunn, which is very art house, and so I'm always slow to throw that in the category of the horror subgenre blaxploitation. But, you know, there's movies like Blackenstein, which is just absolutely terrible, one of the worst movies ever made. You know, Dr. Black, Mr. White, or whatever the title was.
Yeah, with Bernie Casey.
By Bill Crane.
Yep.
Directed Blackula. That's really bad too. Sugar Hill is probably one of the better ones. Sugar Hill, JD's Revenge is also pretty good. JD's Revenge was directed by Marks, I believe, Arthur Marks, who was like a TV guy. Did a lot of episodes of Perry Mason.
Okay.
My mind is slipping. I'm on cold medicine right now, so you're not getting me on my A game.
Oh no, but you on cold medicine is good for a pledge show. We appreciate that. I do like Sugar Hill, and I don't know. Maybe I should watch them back to back. But I remember being very, very satisfied with the outcome when it was all said and done.
Yeah, Sugar Hill is a great movie. It's got I love the soundtrack, and Don Pedro Colley as Baron Samedi is like, he's amazing. And some of the makeup in it is kind of hokey, but there's a couple pretty creepy moments in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think that one was released on home video. Maybe I shouldn't admit this. I just have this huge bootleg collection like of old VHS tapes. I still just watch a lot of those most of the time because it's just, you know, there's nostalgia involved in popping in a VHS tape.
I can understand that. I didn't hear what you said about bootleg, but I understand that. and I was just remembering, because full disclosure, I have a DVD copy of Abby, but that's not really saying anything. It's like you kind of took a VHS run of it and slapped it onto a disc.
Yeah, that's, you know, and that's an interesting movie right there, too. You know, William Marshall's in that, and that movie has such an incredible history, and it is, I watch it for the laughs more than anything else.
Yes.
But it's also fun just because, you know, William Marshall's in it. He's a great actor, an amazing actor. Off Stoker's in it. It has a really good cast. It has an interesting premise, but it is so poorly executed and that, you know, the laughs are all unintentional, but they're pretty good, solid laughs. I mean, I feel like in life, you take laughs where you can get them, even if they're unintentional.
And that film goes down a weird sexual path for a bit.
Yes, it does.
So
because, you know, the Carol Speed is the sort of dowdy housewife who is possessed, not by the devil, but possessed by, you know, this African deity of fertility or virility or something like that. And so she, you know, becomes sort of insatiable, the insatiable housewife.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, I don't know if it's really true that, you know, Warner Brothers sued the producers because it was too close to The Exorcist. That's sort of the urban legend surrounding that movie. But if you look at film, there was a whole bunch of movies that were Exorcist ripoffs.
Yeah.
That never you know, weren't shut down, weren't taken away from public eye the way Abby was. So I'm still trying to find out what the if that's the true story or just some, you know, something that made it more intriguing.
Because I thought it was labeled Black Exorcist for overseas markets.
That was my understanding too.
Right, because that always pops up when you do a reference check on this. But yeah, I don't see Warner Brothers. Yeah, maybe it's easier to pick on an American film than say trying to go overseas and stopping Beyond the Door or any of the Italian ripoffs.
Yeah, exactly. I think there was one called Jennifer or something like that.
Something like that. Yeah. Thank you, IMDb, for killing all sorts of time at work. I want to shift gears a little bit, and because I watched your documentary over the week to prepare for this, and I love calling this work. But I wanted to ask you, how's your Shaft series coming?
It's coming along good. We're wrapping up the first story arc for Dynamite. It's actually issue 5 is due out next week, and then issue 6 is the final issue of this story arc. I'm not sure what they're doing afterwards. I've got enough other things on my plate that are keeping me busy, but I'm also lettering that series, so I have 2 pages left to finish lettering for issue 6, but it's coming along good, and it's been well received. It's been nominated for a couple of awards, and people seem to be responding to it very, very positively, so I couldn't be happier.
You all right?
Yep. Sorry. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
We don't have the cough button in front of me because it's I'm not in the studio with you.
I understand, but it keeps it as live as humanly possible. were able to do this? I mean, was this something that he had to talk to the Tiedemann family to get permission, or I don't know what the legalities are as far as being able to make a comic based on a character that's already been created.
Yeah. No. I reached out to the estate, to his widow. And she got me in touch with the agency that represents the estate. She was really into the idea. I approached her and said, you know, I love the books. And I was honest. I said, I like the books more than I like the movies. And I'd be really interested in doing a comic or graphic novels with the character. And she, you know, responded very positively, got me in touch with the agent. It's an agency out of New York that reps the estate. And that was how the whole thing happened. And then I found a publisher who was interested, and I got both parties together. And that took almost a year for them to iron out all the details. And but yeah, that's how it was. It was you know, Shaft was a character that I always wanted to do something with in terms of comics, because that's sort of my first love is comic books. I always wanted to do a Shaft comic book, and so we. That's how it happened. And now, interestingly enough, I'm trying to do a Blackula comic, but I don't know. Getting MGM to give up the rights for a reasonable amount, I don't know if they're going to go for it or not.
Would you do the two films and then expand?
What I would do is I would take elements. Well, a lot of it would depend on what the license calls, you know, what the license says. I would, rather than do the two films, I would take elements of the films and then expand on them and really sort of get into just the character of Mama Walde, of Blackula, more in depth and sort of run with some of the socio-political aspects that are there or just under the surface in the movies.
Mm-hmm.
And really play with it. Play with him is like this really tragic anti-hero more than anything else. But like I said, you know, a lot of it depends on if there's a publisher who wants to do it and if MGM is willing to let that license be played with.
Fingers crossed on that. Going back to Shaft, how many Shaft novels were there?
7. And now there are 8 because I just finished writing the 8th one, which is the first one since 1975. I just finished writing a novel called Shaft's Revenge. I have no idea what the release date is on that for the physical copy of the book. And it takes place in between the 3rd and 4th Shaft books, which are Shaft's Big Score and then Shaft Has a Ball. So Shaft's Revenge takes place in between those two.
Okay. And were any of the novel? Because it's been a long time since I've seen the series. Were any of the novels made into episodes from the TV series?
No, nothing was. None of the books were turned into anything for the TV show. And you know, the TV show is sort of one of those things. Like, yeah, let's just kind of forget that ever happened. You know, they really watered down the character a lot on the TV show. I mean, I feel they watered him down significantly in the movies compared to the character in the books. And so, what I wanted to do with the comics was sort of get back to the heart and soul of who that character was, especially in the first novel. It's really gritty pulp. Detective sort of story.
I was going to say, is John Schaff more watered down than James Bond?
I would say they're probably about the same, actually. You know, in the books, he's you know, this he's a vet of the Vietnam War, and he's a much more cold blooded killer in the books, and a little bit more disturbed in the books, and you don't get that much of a sense of that. He's more just the cool cat in the movies. You don't really understand, you know, why killing comes so easy for him and all that sort of stuff. So that's what I was having fun playing with.
Okay. I want to go to your documentary, Macked, Hammered, Slaughtered, and Shafted, which is a lot of fun, and go check it out if you haven't already. My first thing was, how long did it take for you to gather all of those interviews? I mean, the talking heads you have in this film are really impressive.
Yeah, you know, the interview, it was an interesting time. I conducted the vast majority of those interviews between 1996 and 97, 98. There's one or two that came along like 98, 99, but the vast majority of them were conducted the summer of 96 and then early 1997. That was the vast majority of them. And I spent a lot of time editing it. There's a whole bunch of technical setbacks, and then there's the financial setbacks, too. So I didn't finish the movie. I want to say it took me like almost 7 years to actually finish it. I think I finally finished it in 2003 or something like that, maybe a little bit sooner than that. It felt like forever, though. It really did. It felt like... you know, and it was kind of sad because by the time I finished it, William Marshall had passed away shortly before I finished it, and then Ron O'Neill passed away maybe within a couple weeks of finishing it. And then since then, several more people passed. Rudy Ray Moore is gone. Jim Kelly is gone. And so I look at it now, and it's I realize, like, you know, there's an importance to it that sometimes is difficult for me to see. And then I remember, oh, wow, there's some people I interviewed who never really had a chance to go on the record and say some of the things that they finally got to say when I sat down to interview them. Mm-hmm.
And how was Marshall at the time? Because I thought you alluded to that his health was starting to decline. Well, I couldn't remember when you exactly interviewed him, but I know he died before the release.
He, you know, when I interviewed him, he passed away from complications to Alzheimer's. There was, you know, when I interviewed him, it wasn't publicly known that he had it, and no one said to me that he had it, but I could tell my two of my grandparents I'd lost to Alzheimer's. So I recognized some of the symptoms. And when I went to interview him, there was part of me that was like, you know, really not sure if I should do it. And I talked to his wife at the time before the interview, and I said, you know, he agreed to do it. He agreed to do the interview. And then I talked to her, and I said, are you sure? And she said, no, this will be very good for him. It's very therapeutic. And so... you know, we did the interview, and it was a great experience, you know. And it wasn't, I know someone who interviewed him after the fact. So I interviewed him in 96. Okay. I know someone who interviewed him around 98 or 99. And I talked to them afterwards, and they said at that point that his memory was really, really bad. he was having just more trouble remembering names and dates. But in terms of, you know, sort of the bigger picture of things, he was still pretty good.
Mm-hmm. And where did you interview Jim Kelly? Because he was always the one that seemed like he kind of disappeared off the face of the earth, and then, boom, we see him in a commercial with LeBron James.
I interviewed Jim Kelly in, at the time, he was living in Marina Del Rey, in, you know, which is right next to Los Angeles. And I interviewed him. He lived in this huge apartment complex that had like a almost like a park in the courtyard. It had this little fountain and a waterfall with ducks and all that sort of stuff. And that's where I interviewed him. And unfortunately, the sound quality on his interview is terrible because there was this waterfall fountain thing right near us that the sound person on that particular day was not well trained. And you know, I kept saying, you know, how's, you sure the waterfall's not making too much noise? And they kept saying, oh, no, it sounds fine. And looking back years later, I think what they meant by sounds fine was, yeah, I can hear it perfectly over, you know, Jim Kelly talking. So I've had to learn to live with that. But he just sort of went into his own, you know, Jim went into his own little world of, you know, he had his karate school, and then he was a tennis pro. And that's where he spent most of his time, was in the world of tennis. And he worked in real estate as well. And just, he was pretty disgusted by Hollywood and had his burning desire to go back was never so great that he was willing to compromise his integrity. And so, you know, there were offers that were coming to him periodically, but he would always turn them down. It was always for stuff like, you know, a lot of comedies and things like that. And he still took himself very seriously.
Well, I remember, you kind of almost blinked and you missed him in One Down, Two to Go. And I wondered if that was a favor to Fred Williamson, and the fact that he got to work with, reunite with all these guys, even for a brief moment.
You know, and I never talked to him about that one. I think One Down, Two to Go was like what made him go, I never want to make another movie again, you know. he was treated so poorly. His character was treated so poorly in that film. And I think he just found, you know, it's interesting because he doesn't have a very big filmography, but he has this, you know, he had a much larger than life persona about him. And I've always sort of speculated that for him to come out of retirement and make another movie, like he left a very big pair of shoes to fill.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if he ever, you know, felt comfortable trying to refill those shoes. Like he, you know, and I saw him periodically over the years after the interview. Last time I saw him was maybe 2-3 years before he passed away. And he seemed very happy and content. And at that time, there was a project that I was talking about doing, and I told him about it. And he was like, yeah, you know, if it works out and the money's right, just give me a call. And it never worked out. And it wasn't because had nothing to do with him. It just had to do with the finances of the project itself.
Mm-hmm. Watching the documentary, I love the fact that you mentioned that Blaxploitation did not start in 1972.
Yeah.
And it goes all the way back to the beginning of film itself.
Oh, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to get technical, it goes back even before the beginning of the film.
Well, yes. Historically, yeah.
Yeah.
And something else that I think of, you know, Soul Cinema, the DVD releases at MGM UA, you know, and there's a lot of films that get lumped into the so-called blaxploitation, and I've always loved Fred Williamson's comment on that. You know, my check's cleared, I'm not getting exploited. But for me, films like Cooley High and Claudine and Five on the Black Hand Side, you know, they're not exploitative films.
No, they're not. And so that's when you begin to realize, like, okay, like that word was just thrown around pretty with fairly reckless disregard.
Mm-hmm.
Like how anyone could look at Cooley High or Claudine as a blaxploitation movie is it's definitely way beyond me in my ability to comprehend. And so I just I use that term more just to talk about the era more than the films themselves. It's just easier for me anyway.
And as far as, you know, the double-edged sword of, yes, they're not the, sometimes they're not the greatest characters in the world, sometimes they're not the greatest roles in the world, but it had a lot of people working, and more than one person in the documentary said it was a much-needed moment of empowerment.
Yeah.
So
I agree. And I think that we're in need of something along those lines. Again, we can, you know, I'd like to see more movies like Cooley High and Claudine, for sure, you know. Mm-hmm. But I'd also love to see, you know, I saw The Equalizer recently with Denzel Washington. And, you know, it was a good movie. It was okay, but it wasn't better than Trouble Man, you know, that Ivan Dixon directed with Robert Hooks. Trouble Man was a way better movie than Equalizer. And so they're still making, you know, pseudo-blaxploitation movies. I just don't think they're making them as well. In fact, most Denzel Washington movies over the last 10 years, Training Day and all that other stuff, they're all blaxploitation films.
Right, just a bigger budget, and the studio is actually backing it.
Yeah, I mean, American Gangster, come on. That was Black Caesar. That was Black Caesar on a $100 million budget.
I interviewed Guy Davis, and I asked him, it was right after his mom got nominated, and you know, I remember being in the theater, and the joke was she got nominated because she slapped Denzel, and the entire audience just gasped when that happened. And Guy Davis's response was, "Who do you think been training all these decades for to get ready for that scene?"
Yeah, so it's interesting. I'm pushing for a new wave of blaxploitation. I think we need it. I'm still trying to figure out exactly what it will look like, because, you know, a lot of the stuff that we're getting isn't, again, I'm not fulfilled by it, but maybe that's just me. Maybe I'm just an old grumpy man these days.
Well, I guess, what were your feelings on Black Dynamite?
You know, Black Dynamite was entertaining. I didn't particularly love it, but I will say, love the animated show.
Mm-hmm.
I think the animated show is so much funnier than the movie. But I feel like Black Dynamite, which, you know, follows in the footsteps of Undercover Brother and I'm Gonna Keep You Sucka, all those are, it's a pretty easy target. It's pretty easy to do a parody or satire of blaxploitation. And it's like, and that's why I think with the Shaft comic, why so many people were surprised, because I think they were expecting something like Black Dynamite. And I was like, no, if you read those books, there's some really good, you know, action. There's some really good melodrama there. Why do we have to make a parody of everything? Why do we have to turn everything into some sort of ironic joke? And that's what I'd love to see. I mean, I think Michael Jai White is a great action star. I'd love to see him do more straight action stuff than just, you know, the Black Dynamite style comedy. I'd rather watch him in action than, you know, there's some other, not that many right now, but certainly more so, you know, I never need to see another Chuck Norris thing, and I don't need to see Stallone do any more action movies, you know. Same with Schwarzenegger. Those guys have all sort of outlived their time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, step aside.
I would say, besides backing, what I mean, are we? You're talking about a new wave. Obviously, keeping it in modern setting, and I guess I asked that because of if you went for a throwback feel, or if you took characters from back then. I mean, like, for instance, I guess I'm making this question longer, but for in the comics that you do of Shaft, is it in a modern setting?
The Shaft comic is set. No, it's a period piece. It's
okay.
Set. The story that I'm currently writing, or I've written and is coming out, is set in 69. It's how he becomes a private detective. It's his first case. The novel I wrote was 72, 73. They were period pieces, but for me, one of the most important aspects of that character of John Shaft, like in the top three most important aspects of who he is the fact that he's a Vietnam War vet. And if you take that away from him, you take away a huge part of what makes him such an interesting character. And you couldn't make him, even if you try to make him a Gulf War vet, it still would not be it wouldn't have the same impact because the Vietnam War was very different than the Gulf War in terms of the impact that it had on America and the understanding of what we had of what war and the military-industrial complex does to America's young men. And so for me, it was like, it was always, there was never any question in my mind, he has to stay in that era. He has to be a veteran of this particular war. And anyone who disagreed with me was like in for a fight. But that's just me.
So I guess what I'm saying is if you ask about looking for a new wave of action stars, and it would be obviously in a modern setting.
Yeah, it could be in any setting, you know, and I feel like modern would be great. I'd love to see some more futuristic and some action stuff. You know, I mean, you look at a guy like, you know, not to pick on Stallone or Schwarzenegger or guys like that, but these guys are all grandfathers now, you know, and they're getting to make anything. They still get to make the movies they want, set in whatever era they want, and yet, you know, Michael Jai White is barely making anything. You know, he's lucky if he gets to make a movie for The Asylum, you know, which are the guys that made movies like Snakes on a Train and, you know, all these knockoff films. In fact, I think he made a movie for them called, like, Cyborg Cop or something like that. But, yeah, I mean, I'd love to see Michael Jai White. There's no reason why isn't he in the new Terminator movie, right?
Right.
Why isn't he the star of the new Terminator movie? And there's a whole lot of other actors out there that I'd love to see doing some stuff. And so I'd love to see, you know, I'm a big sci-fi fan. I'd love to see some really good good blaxploitation sci-fi movie. But, you know, I'll take whatever I can get at this point. You know, I'm an old man who's still looking for some heroes that he can relate to.
By the way, just when you were saying that, Fred Williamson just stood in front of Michael Jai White.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he's raising his hand.
Excuse me, sorry about that. I apologize for being sick. You can blame it on the kid on the plane who was coughing on me the other day. So,
you know, we call it radio verite. It's all right. So what have you had done recently on badassmofo.com? Sorry.
That's my neglected best friend more so than anything else. I'm so busy doing other things that I don't get to work on it as much as I'd like to. I'm writing for DC Comics right now. And I just finished up all the Shaft stuff for Dynamite Entertainment. Now I'm writing a new book for DC. I'm working on my new novel. And so unless something like really sparks me, I don't seem to update it nearly as much as I should. And so therefore I'm guilty of being one of those web people, one of those bloggers who just does not, you know, I'm not taking care of it as much as I should.
That's okay. I think we're the same way on filmsociology.tumblr.com. I think one of the more recent postings we had was the Blackula trailer to announce the Blu-ray release. So you're all right.
Oh wow. Okay. Yeah. So you guys are way behind than I am.
Yeah. So and you have apparently more on your plate. We're just doing pledge week, so it's okay.
Yeah.
So I guess just to wrap things up, David, I would say what films have you watched recently, whether it's new or whether it's old, that have that caught your mind?
You know, I've been so bad about watching movies recently. I finally saw Interstellar a couple days ago, like a week ago. My cousin sat me down and showed it to me, and I was really tired, so I got confused.
Not a good situation.
Yeah. I was like, oh, wait a second. Is he in the fifth dimension? What's going on?
And members of the fifth dimension.
Yeah. I'm trying to, what was the last thing that I watched that really, wow, isn't that terrible? I can't think of anything that I said. Like, I haven't been to the movies. I haven't been to the theater since January. I saw Birdman in January. Here it is March. I mean, I used to go to the movies every week, and now I've just been so busy, I just haven't done it. So I don't, you know, I'm getting ready to go see, you know, I'll go see Avengers when it comes out. I'm looking forward to that. I think the last movie, other than Interstellar, was The Equalizer. I watched that on video when that came out, and I still want to see John Wick, but I just haven't gotten around to it.
John,
I'm kind of lame these days.
You're working. Stupid work gets in the way.
Which is lame.
Yes, yes, the days of laying on the couch and plowing through four films in a single day. That's a start. I understand. John Wick is fun. John Wick is a 70s action film, just shot like a 90s and aught action film.
So, all right. Well, you know, there's worse things to be, I guess.
There are worse things out there. So, but David, I really, really appreciate your time on this. And I'm really happy now that I have both Blackula films on Blu-ray. The world's a better place. And I appreciate you coming on. And I appreciate your information on this show as well as on the Blu-ray and everything you do.
Well, no, thank you for having me on. I know it took us a while to make it all work out, but I appreciate you having me.
This is another example, ladies and gentlemen, of social media used for good, not for evil. It's not just for stalking anymore. But we're going to take a short break. But first, Kobe, can we play him our break music? This has been our break music since day one on the show. I think our film show gives Gene Page a royalty check every quarter. David, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, take care.
Yeah, take care.
That's David Walker. He did the Blu-ray commentary for Blackula. I'm a giddy child. Let's take a short break, and we'll wrap the show up. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD To The Point, WFYI.org. And we're back. Welcome back to Film. So we've broken format here at Film Sociology.
That's not new.
No, it's not. 1-800-233-0020 or WFYI.org to support Film Sociology and all the other shows on HD2 as well as HD1. Well, ladies and gentlemen, sometimes we have to work the show around the guest.
Yeah.
So, and definitely wanted David on the show, and that was a lot of fun. So, which means, Kobe, you now have to watch Blackula. Now that you've
I know.
No?
No, I we'll see you. I mean, we talk about it on here so much.
Yeah, that's right. Because here at Film Sociology, we are pro Blackula.
It's like, you know what? If
it's not going to freak you out compared to the others.
No, I'm not worried about that.
I know you're.
I was just thinking, like, if we had a statistician count, like, the number of times over the course of a year that we talk about Blackula and The Room.
And by the way, May 5th is when Riff Tracks is showing The Room in Fathom Events live theaters all over the country.
Before we get to our dead people that we like, you want to run through a couple things going on?
Yes,
we should
bring up our alma mater. I know everyone at IU has been waiting patiently to hear what's going on.
Yeah.
Not really. They have a website, too. All right, go.
Tonight, 6:30, IU Cinema down in Bloomington, we have Guy Madden presents L'Âge d'Or.
And Guy Madden's going to be on campus.
Yes, and then follow that up tonight at 9:30 from 2006, Brand Upon the Brain. Saturday, April 11th, La Notte Brava at 3 o'clock, that from 1959. Then we have Archangel from 1990 at 6:30. And then Tales from Gimli Hospital from 1988 at 9:30. That's down at IU Cinema. And again, Sunday, April 12th. 3 p.m. Dracula, Pages from a Virgin's Diary, and then at 6:30, Waiting for Happiness, foreign language drama from 2002. And then tonight at the IMA, 7 o'clock, Music and Movies,
oh, yeah.
The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
That's going to be great. I don't care what Ed Johnson Ott says. But yeah, talking about the brilliant music of Ennio Morricone in the masterpiece, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Worth
it.
And then tomorrow at the IMA, Music and Movies again. With Bonnie and Clyde.
That's excellent. Have you seen Bonnie and Clyde?
Not the version they're going to show.
No, not the original.
I've seen Faye Dunaway.
This is Faye Dunaway. Yeah, and Warren Beatty.
Is it?
Yes. Directed by Arthur Penn. Gene Hackman's in it. Gene Wilder's got a small part.
Hang on a second. I got to verify
this. You can make sure I'm right or I'm wrong. Well, while you're doing that, tonight at the Historic Artcraft Theater, tonight at 7:30 and tomorrow at 2 and 7:30 p.m., another film you two, you and Bianca, should go check out. From 1938, James Cagney and Pat O'Brien in Angels with Dirty Faces. Fine, fine crime drama. Am I right still? What, you don't recognize Faye Dunaway?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it is.
She was 60s pretty.
Yeah.
And 70s pretty.
Mm-hmm.
And then kind of went nutty in the 80s. So anyway, that is happening here. Also opening in theaters, just the documentary Hunting Ground from Kirby Dick, who gave us This Film Is Not Yet Rated and Outrage. Ethan Hawke's documentary on Seymour Bernstein called Seymour, An Introduction. And then while we're young, the latest film from Noah Baumbach, which you can read Ed Johnson-Ott's review in Nouveau, also the film Wild Tales. So there's plenty to see out there now that college basketball season is over.
Yep.
And you can watch the Pacers so long as they're not getting stabbed at nightclubs. But yeah, we have time for Dead People We Like because we don't have time.
Annual show of Dead People We Like.
There's a pretty big one this
we
week.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Yes.
Not at all.
No, but a lot of that guys and that voice. Voice artist Stan Freberg passed away this week at the age of 88. Was with regular voices at Warner Brothers and Looney Tunes. So things like Bugs Bunny and the Three Bears, The Hick Chick, Bare Feet, A Bear for Punishment, Cheese Chasers, lots of stuff out there. Films like Calloway Went That Away, It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, Tom Thumb. Anyway, lots of stuff out. Lady and the Tramp, he was Beaver in that. So.
Oh, that voice.
Yes, that voice. Now, also, we have Tom Towles, who worked in films like Miami Vice, done by Michael Mann, The Devil's Rejects, the remake of Halloween by Rob Zombie, of course, Gridlocked, House of a Thousand Corpses. He was on NYPD Blue, of course, films like The Rock, Mad Dog and Glory. Best known for his fourth acting gig, he played Otis in Henry, A Portrait of a Serial Killer. Richard Dysart, who was in a bunch of films like Hard Rain, Panther, Wall Street, Pale Rider, was a regular on L.A. Law, was in The Thing, Being There, An Enemy of the People, The Hindenburg, Day of the Locust, was in The Hospital, and then two really fine character actors, although my wife reminds me all actors are character actors.
Technically, yes.
Jeffrey Lewis, besides being the father of Juliet Lewis, worked in a number of Clint Eastwood films. He was that guy in Thunderbolt and Lightfoot, High Plains Drifter, both Loose movies, Every Which Way But Loose, Any Which Way You Can. Also was in The Devil's Rejects, The Man Without a Face, Point of No Return, Maverick, Night of the Comet, Stitches, 10 to Midnight, much, much more, Bronco Billy. And then James Best. Yes, he's known best as Roscoe P. Coltrane from The Dukes of Hazzard, but this was a guy that was a working actor for 65 years.
Wow.
Starred in films way before working with Burt Reynolds and Dukes of Hazzard. The Killer Shrews, which is a Mystery Science Theater favorite and also a late night favorite, was in Shock Corridor, directed by Sam Fuller. Actually, you're going to hear a song from a film that he appeared in on Tomorrow Night's Blues House Party. He was the sheriff in Sounder. That's the one with Cicely Tyson, Paul Winfield, music by Taj Mahal. Worked with Reynolds quite a bit in Dan August, Run Simon Run. Was his best right-hand man in Hooper. Also was in The End. Rolling Thunder with Tommy Lee Jones and William Devane, Nickelodeon with Burt Reynolds and directed by Peter Bogdanovich. But yeah, working actor. Salute to all of you, gentlemen. Thank you for your fine, fine work. And thanks to David Walker for coming on the show. And a big shout out to the cast and crew of 12th Night at Earlham College. Do we have some words to live by?
Silent Green is people!
On time.
Zardoz.
Yeah. Look at that. I did it right.
Spoken.
Go see a good movie, you deserve it, or just buy Blackula on Blu-ray. You really should. This is Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org.
We go home. Good night, Fort Myers. Good night, California.